Time to take a look at our weather and climate for the state of Wisconsin and beyond with our two guests. Before we get to that, though, I did want to thank you for contributing during this spring membership drive. You donated more than $265,000, had more than 1,450 listeners pledge, and we got 225 new members. So thank you so much. Your gift ensures Wisconsin has a vital, strong public radio service. And we really, really, really appreciate all of your support. Well, we're turning to weather now. Steve Ackerman has joined me. Steve is director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin will be with us soon, professor and former chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And he's teaching, isn't he?
He's teaching, yep.
He's teaching.
His semester's coming to an end.
His class is coming to an end as we speak, and he'll be rushing over here to talk about the weather and what the heck happened in the month of April.
Oh, boy, was that a weird month or not. And I think one thing we can say is, yeah, it's over. Right? It was a really weird one. It turned out we had that record snowfall back a few days ago, over 7 inches of really wet snow. And that made for the 2017-2018 winter season, made April the snowiest month of that winter, which is a very odd situation. And when we got that, I just learned this the other day, when we got that record snowfall, it also turned out to be the the warmest minimum temperature for that day. So we keep all these, like baseball, we like to keep all these statistics. In addition to keeping the minimums and the maximums, we also keep, what was the warmest minimum that we've ever had? And that occurred on that day as well.
Well, now, I've heard people say already that, well, this is just proves that we're, climate change isn't there. Here we are getting all this snow in April.
Yeah, nope, not quite. I should say it wasn't a record in terms of the most amount of snow that fell on a given day in April. It was the third most amount. And this will likely turn out to be, if not the coldest average April temperature, well, the second coldest average temperature for the month of April. But, this is what happens when we talk about climate change. We focus on the warming, and globally, the Earth is warming, but there's still variations from month to month in terms of whether or not a particular area will be above normal or below normal. And this year, clearly, with the air that poured out of the North Pole region, we were a year and a month when we're below normal.
Yeah. And I was reading somewhere, if climate, the change was not caused by human effects, you would expect to see sort of everywhere, the change coming everywhere instead of in different pieces.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that's true based on, for example, if we go back 1,000 years ago to the Little Ice Age, right? That was an area where there was cooling focused on regional areas in the globe, and not the whole globe. So one of the things what happens when it's either naturally caused change or human caused, which this clearly is on the track for, you're not only causing a warming in general for the global, but you're also changing patterns, and that's them. The real question is how are we changing patterns as we change the atmospheric composition?
Steve Ackerman, our guest today, as we talk weather with him, and I didn't give the number, so let me do it right now. If you have a climate or weather question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. And if you have some weather photos, I hope you'll post those up as well. It used to be a little more difficult to post those photos on the Ideas Network page, but now it's pretty easy. So it's easy for us to see as well. So go ahead. If you've got a good weather photo, we'd love to see that as well. Just go to our Ideas Network Facebook page. And again, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I was reading another, here's me reading again, about tornadoes. And tornadoes. They were expecting fewer tornadoes in places like Oklahoma because of...
Yeah. So again, associated with the cooler April that we've had, this has been a year where at this time, when you look at tornadoes that occur in the U.S., we're about 30%, 33% fewer tornadoes. I mean, two-thirds. So
66.
We're only, 66% fewer tornadoes than we normally would have across the U.S. at this time of year. And Oklahoma, I'm actually going out there tomorrow to visit.
Oklahoma has 90 tornadoes.
Right. I'm very happy to go and visit out there. And I think it's correlated to what we saw for our April, in that when cold air comes out of the Arctic region and influences our weather, it's also dry. And one of the ingredients for severe weather is we need moist, warm air near the ground. And so we're just not getting that in Oklahoma and much of the Midwest. And so we haven't had any tornadoes, which personally I think is a good thing.
Yeah, that part's good. That part is really good. On the bad side, here we are now. We've had some wildfires in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, I had heard that this has been a record time for the number of fires that are now occurring in western Wisconsin because it's so dry. And part of that is, again, from the weather point of view, we have all this cool, dry air coming down, so that dries out the fuel that feeds these fires.
And there was a lot of snow up there in the winter, but it's...
There was a lot of snow, but it's gone.
It's no longer there.
And it's
dry. So what do you... Are we out of the woods yet in terms of winter?
I'm hoping so. It looks like we're going to be going back to a normal type of pattern coming up for this early, for this May and June period.
Well, I used my snow shovel over the weekend, but it was because I was raking leaves out of my flower beds, and the snow shovel worked really
good for that.
Once I got it raked out, I raked it right onto my snow shovel
into the wheelbarrow. Right in April, you used it for snow and for leaves.
There we go. Well, Kate in Menasha has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This might be a little early in the season, but it's a general question I've had for a while, and it's happened to me. I'm out in the country walking my dog on a trail, and a storm comes along that actually contains some lightning and thunder. It'd take me too long to run back to my car, and there's no structure. There might be some woods or trees. What is the best thing to do? And I know you can't really answer pet questions, but you have a dog with you. So, should you lay on the ground? Should you go stand by a tree? What's the best thing to do?
Yeah, boy, if it's a thunderstorm, you don't want to lay on the ground, and you don't want to go underneath a tree. Because that increases your threat to getting hit by lightning. For lightning, they typically recommend that you get to protective cover, whether it's your car or a building or something like that, or you crouch down on the balls of your feet. So you minimize contact with the ground in case a lightning bolt hits nearby, because it will travel along the ground. But I would imagine if you got a dog, that they're not going to be patient with thunder and lightning all around, and if there's hail as well. So, I would think the best thing you could probably do is try to hustle off as best you can to get, back to your vehicle where there's good protection for both you and the pet.
Yeah. Keep your eyes on the weather before you go out, I guess.
Yeah, right, and be prepared as much as you can. But sometimes those thunderstorms, they'll forecast accurately that we're going to get a thunderstorm in this area, but, specifically where it pops up is really hard to predict.
Kate, thank you. Appreciate your call. We have some more callers online, but John Martin has joined us. Hi, John.
Hey, Larry. Steve.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Oh, great. Just to remind, John Martin is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, and John and Steve come by the last Monday of every month.
And this is April, the last day of April.
Last day of April. Yeah. Unbelievable,
huh? Glad to get over that, right?
Yeah, what a month. Yeah. What a month.
Although we had good snow for you.
It was great. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying what a month in glowing terms. I'm sure I'm in the minority. Everyone else is glad to see it go. I wish we had another one like it.
We're not likely to get it, though.
No, we are not. Zero chance.
It really does feel like we turned the corner, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does today through most of the...
Well, you know,
Wisconsin.
In some ways, the longer you go through April when it's cold like it was, it's inevitable that's going to be the feeling. You know, you just knew it was going to be coming. I think 10 days from now, we'll have dew points in the 60s, and people will be saying, oh, this summer is awful. They'll be right, but right. It'll be that sudden, I think. Right. Oh, man.
Well, you can join in with your own questions and comments. We have Tom in Mineral Point with a question here. I don't know if Tom from Mineral Point is in there or not. Let's see. Tom, are you there?
Yeah.
What's on your mind?
Well, I live just a little bit west of Mineral Point on a farm, and we've gone all winter. I never had to scrape the driveway, and I listen to the weatherman. They talk about big storms coming, and then we get to the river, and they cliff, and I noticed there in the drought monitor, we're in the yellow again now, right? Here in southwest Wisconsin. I was wondering, are we going to get the rain this summer?
Thank you so much for that question, Tom. We'll have a chance to comment on that or get our weather guys to think about it. John Martin and Steve Ackerman from the UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. But we take a look at the news, then we'll do it. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, as is John Martin, who's also with us. John, also former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Weather or climate questions for them, I hope you'll join in. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post a question and a weather photo on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We'd love to see those as well. Well, before we broke for the news, I believe Tom was on, Western Wisconsin guy, farmer, wondering about drought and what are the... You know, what's the outlook for rain, not only immediately, but in the summer?
Yeah, I mean, as he pointed out, that area of Wisconsin is drying out, and they're in a weak drought. It's not what's called a weak drought.
Yeah.
It's not a moderate drought.
Right.
And that's leading to the fires we talked about earlier as well. In terms of relief, you know, the seasonal outlook is, you know, up in the air in terms of whether it'll be an above normal precipitation or below or normal. So I don't think you want to flip
six
a coin, but
the weather in the spring and summer is going to be, well, especially in the summer, the rain's going to be carried by short-lived convective storms. And anybody who says they can make a forecast of the seasonality of that in a locale is kidding you. And for the next couple of months, we have a chance for the delivery of fairly good precipitation by organized weather systems. We got one coming Wednesday night, Thursday, which may have some beneficial effect across the southern part of the whole state. But, aside from that, you know, going out 5 or 6 days is about as far as you can go with any sort of confidence.
And actually, the more southern part of the state is also very dry right now in terms of the precipitation, where we're at with precipitation.
Yeah.
So they could use it even if it doesn't hit the west side.
Well, you know, we were just chatting in between, too, about the fact that our 7 inches of snow a couple of Wednesdays ago disappeared without it being muddy around here, at least in Madison.
Right.
I suppose that's true over the whole southern set of southern counties. And that testifies to how much room there is in the ground for water. I mean, it just, some of it evaporated, of course, after it melted, but good part of it probably sunk right in and hardly noticeable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is amazing to me. Well, we have a caller online, Dave in La Crosse. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. But let's turn to Dave in La Crosse right now. What's on your mind, Dave?
Hi, thanks. A couple of things. First, Wisconsin may have had the coldest April on record, but the Arctic Ocean, I see, had the warmest April on record, and it's 100 times as big as Wisconsin. But the thing I called in about, there was a NOVA documentary a week or two ago called Decoding the Weather Machine, and I thought it was a really good summary of, you know, 160 years of climate science. I just wondered what you guys thought of it, if you've seen it.
So I haven't seen it, but the title is familiar, and I'm wondering if you know if it was based on a book or not.
I don't think it was. I'm not sure, but okay. Actually, it was NOVA, which is sponsored by David Koch, which is kind of surprising.
Right, yeah.
Anyway.
No, we don't get cable, so I have to kind of wait until it gets posted someplace else.
Well, like Steve, I think I've hearing the title a couple of times, it sounds familiar, but I'm sure I haven't seen the show yet. But I'm going to look it up. I'm very interested to see what it's all about.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. You must have enjoyed it, Dave.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks.
All right, thanks very much. Appreciate your call.
You know, going back to his comment about the Arctic, you know, this is a year where the sea ice extent is really low up in the Arctic. So he's right there that's going down.
Yeah, and it's, so what can we expect if this keeps going?
I think it gets some momentum, because if you have reduced ice pack at the end of February, when it reaches its annual maximum extent, if it erodes rapidly after then, which I think is certainly encouraged by a warm April, then you enter the summer with less than your normal sea ice, and the summer is, you know, going to really erode it. That happens every year, and we might end up with our lowest amount ever by the end of September, which is the seasonal minimum, because we had such an early start on the melting in April. So it's very scary, and that means a lot of energy that otherwise gets wasted, bounced off the ice, gets absorbed by the ocean, and the high latitudes stay warmer for a longer period of time. And it could mean more snows for some of the places on the north coast of Europe and north coast of North America, and an early start to our cold season, ironically.
Well, one of the other things we were talking about during our news break was snowfall in Wisconsin. We're mentioning snow here, and I'm wondering, what was the latest we've ever had snow here in the state?
In the state is a good question.
I mean, last spring.
Yeah, I don't know when the latest date anywhere in Wisconsin is. I think the latest date in Madison is something on the order of May 10th, where we've had measurable snow. I don't know if that's actually the latest date ever, but it's probably darn close. And then I'd guess some places up, maybe just offshore of the lake, not on the lake. The lake, by that time of year, might actually provide a little bit of insulation against a desperate cold. I don't know if that's true or not. But maybe as late as close to Memorial Day, I wouldn't be surprised. There's some places in the state that have had a snow flurry in the air around Memorial Day on some year.
And on Lake Mendota is such a cool lake. If you're somewhere away from Madison, you may or may not know about Lake Mendota, but it's a huge lake, and it's probably the most studied.
It is the most studied lake in the world.
Yeah.
Even beats Lake Victoria. Believe that?
Oh, you're kidding.
No. It's not just weather, but everything included. It's the most studied lake in the world.
Well, the ice off on Lake Mendota is always an interesting thing.
Yeah.
When the ice first breaks. And this year, I'm not sure what the date was.
I don't remember either.
I don't remember when it was either. Yeah. I might have been away too. It might have been spring break week.
Yeah.
And then it was even though it was cold in April, it wasn't cold enough to put the ice on top.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when was the last time, or the latest, the ice ever went off of Lake?
The latest I think I heard today was May 6th, 1857. And that's right about at the beginning of the record. I think the record began in 1852 or 1. So it was early in the record. And then we were chasing the coldest April ever in Madison. We lost by a good amount. But we were chasing April of 1881. And that was the other year where, at least one other year, where the ice came off in early May, May 3rd, 1881. So it's amazing. We're nowhere near as bad as those years.
Right. So it could have been colder.
It could have been a lot worse.
It definitely was colder.
Yeah. Right?
Well, Jim in Madison has a question. Jim, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. This kind of goes back to climate change a little bit. I'm just wondering how far and how bad is it getting as far as the collapse of the Gulf Stream breaking down, you know, taking the warm water up towards the British Isles and such because of the all the melting of the ice and stuff in Greenland and then freshening up the waters. Are we really getting close or in the near future or whatever of that Gulf Stream breaking down because of the breakup of that?
Yeah, and what you're pointing to, for those who may not be wondering why would we care about an ocean current, is that, you know, there's ways that we transport extra energy out of the tropics into the polar regions, and we do it by weather systems, but we also do it by ocean currents. And one thing that people have been looking at for a number of years now through modeling efforts is whether or not that transport of energy by the Gulf Stream will change. And I had just saw an article that I don't think it's conclusive yet, but they will. The observations were beginning to raise the issue of whether or not the Gulf Stream transport was slowing down, which, again, would really potentially impact the climate of Europe and England and Iceland and those areas.
Yeah, sure. And the way to keep it going is you got to force the water to sink in the North Atlantic. And there's a couple of ways in which that's done broadly. One of them is by raking the North Atlantic by strong winds. There's a strong storm track in the overlying atmosphere in exactly the right spot, and that tends to cause a lot of evaporation, and it just pulls up colder water, and it makes it easier for that convection, we call it, for that water to sink. The other, though, that works against that, of course, is the melting of the ice on Greenland and other places that far north, and it coats the surface of the ocean with fresh water, which is lighter than the salty water, and that makes it, that puts the brakes on the convection, which slows down the whole thermohaline circulation, which can be dangerous. And yeah, there are estimates that it could happen within a lifetime.
Yeah.
In an extreme case,
once it goes, it could go.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're right there yet, but yeah, some of the current work.
It's the first time I've seen an indication that it was being impacted.
Yeah.
Jim, thanks for calling.
Yeah, and I'll just add that, you know, the thing about dealing with ocean currents is that there's just a lot fewer observations than even we get in
that's
the atmosphere.
Right.
We just don't
that's
have
right.
a lot.
And, you know, we don't know exactly what's going to happen to the intensity and frequency of the storms that currently do the job of helping that convection to go on. So if they weaken and they move somewhere else, suddenly there's not as much cooling going on at high latitude, and that also makes a difference for the strength of the circulation. So there's a lot of delicate balances in the balance, as it were.
Jim, thanks again for calling. Let's turn to Pat in Allenton next. Hi, Pat.
Well, hi there. How are you doing, Larry?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Hey, I got I was flying from Australia to New Zealand and then New Zealand back to the U.S., and I'm an AV repaired airplane, so I understand the atmosphere and stuff a little bit. And the sensor or the screen in front of me on the flight from Australia to New Zealand showed 70 below zero at 35,000 feet. Mm. And then on the way back from New Zealand to the U.S., I'm going to guess over the equator-ish kind of, there it was only about zero. And I'm curious if you think that the sensors were bad or can that temperature be that cold at that with Antarctica down there and all that other stuff?
Yeah, sure can.
Yeah, I think at 35,000 feet.
Even if you cross the continental U.S. and going into our winter season, that's what's happening down there right now. Yeah, you'll get temperatures that cold. I was just across the Atlantic Ocean in March, and we had temperatures routinely around minus 70 at 38,000 feet flight level. And then if you go much farther south, closer to the equator, you're still in the troposphere at 35,000 feet, so temperatures aren't that cold. Isn't it dramatic? But it's probably accurate.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. I figured it was probably accurate because they probably use the sensors for other stuff besides just showing us where they're at and what's going on. But
yeah.
I was just curious. That was pretty interesting to see that number that low.
I agree. I completely agree with you. I think that's neat. I've never gone across the equator or into the tropics at high altitude, but that would be kind of fun. Now I'm going to keep my eyes open if I ever get the chance.
There you go. Thanks, Pat. Appreciate the call. Mike from Madison emailed and wonders, why do storms split up when they approach Madison? Storms seem to lose their organized pattern around Madison.
And I think they break up because we want them to hit Madison.
Yeah.
I don't think it's statistically
probably
true.
It doesn't stand up to scrutiny, although the hills to the west probably are a factor in some fraction of the population of storms. But But by and large, I think it's that we remember that we're gunning for a big event for some reason or another. You know, you need your lawn watered or you like thunderstorms and it doesn't happen. And you remember that, but you don't remember the ones that make it.
Yeah, and the way to look at that is you can do composites now of the radar imagery.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You could actually see if there's a hole, couldn't
right.
you? Yeah.
Bill and Bill in Hill Point emailed and wondered what caused the severe hailstorm on April 13th that battered parts of southern Wisconsin from Richland County to Baraboo. We experienced over $30,000 in damage to our roof, deck, and metal barn. The temperature was in the low 30s, and there was no active fronts in the area. It seemed this severe weather caught everybody by surprise.
Except the forecasters, right. I will say they were right on that. That was the Friday, Saturday, Sunday event that was that followed with a couple inches of snow, a really unusual late April snow. My recollection is the forecasters were right on that, saying that you know there's going to be isolated convective thunderstorms and some of them may have hail in them. And I remember kind of stupidly hoping we'd see a little bit of that over us. We got a little flash of lightning, but none of the we had. You know, pea-size hail, and places had marble-size hail.
Yeah,
really
I mean,
bad.
I'm not a big fan of hail, but I remember thinking that, too. Oh, that'd be kind of interesting if we get that over here.
Yeah.
But given that he has $30,000 worth of damage,
yeah, it's not good.
I'm really happy to get over here.
It's not good. But it wasn't poorly forecasted by the professionals. It may have been that everybody on the street, including myself, was kind of saying, wow, this is unusual to see such a thing with, as the caller points out, temperatures so low and no obvious front. The front was well to the south in central Illinois.
Blake emailed and says, do you think the seasons are shifting from what months we have come to expect to different times of the year? For example, winter not feeling like it begins until mid-December, January, and everything else pushed further along.
Yeah, I think there's a variety of ways one could define what is a seasonal shift. And I think one of those is to look at hardiness zones for plants. And you certainly have seen a shift in that growing season. So, yeah, I would say we have seen it.
I agree. Yeah. And one of the ways that I fool around with a little bit is I'm looking at the aerial extent of cold air at a mile above sea level. And recently, I've been paying most of my attention to the winter, but recently I went to the fall, and I calculate the day on which, in all of the last 70 seasons, the northern hemisphere has accrued a billion square kilometers of that cold air. So I add up every day. And it's definitely getting longer into the season before we get there. We're about 2 weeks later now than we were in 1970. Really? Wow. It's late October now instead of early October.
Wow.
Andrew emailed, if the Arctic has been warming significantly and if that air is pushed southward into the central U.S., then shouldn't it have been warmer in April than it was?
No, because it's relative warming.
Warm, right, yeah, relative warming.
You know,
what
against,
does that mean?
It means against the average that usually you'd see in the Arctic 50 years ago. It's now 3 degrees warmer, but that doesn't make it absolutely warm in the Arctic. So it's still colder to the north than it is to the south on most days in the northern hemisphere, even though it might be warmer further north than it used to be.
Yeah, and that's key. We should really be keying on that word relative, because winter is never going to go away.
Yeah, that's
it's
right.
just going to be relatively less than what it's.
Yeah. right. And you mentioned averages, and Marilyn emailed and said meteorologists always refer to average temperatures. How are those averages calculated? Are recent warmer temps part of the calculation?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. The average is updated every 10 years. Yes. And so you use the last 30 years are used as the standard average for right now we'd be using 1980 to 2010 for our average. We'll update it at 2020. It'll go 1990 to 2020 and into the next decade. That'll be our 30-year standard average. Yeah. So it is updated.
Let's go back to the phones. Jeff in Kenosha next. Hi, Jeff. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I remember back in the 70s, I'd read a science fiction book to really capture my imagination about the coming ice age, and I guess maybe geologically we're due for one. I was wondering, if an ice age came, would it cancel global warming, or would global warming cancel the ice age?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The ice age that's coming comes on geological timescales, and so I think the question would be, are we going to be around when the next geological ice age comes around? Thinking about it, the geological ice ages that we see on geological history are related to the amount of energy that we get from the sun due to our orbit, and that orbit is always changing on geological timescales. So there would certainly be some offset because you're not getting as much solar energy into the planet, which would tend to cool it. Now, whether or not it would, you know, if we continued on the type of track that we're on with regard to humans influencing the climate, if we're still around in 200,000 years, whether or not it'd be enough to offset that warming so that we wouldn't get ice form, I'm not sure what.
Yeah, I think you're right on. It's a timescale difference, you know, that human beings are influencing the climate on a much more rapid timescale than what the geological timescales are going to be able to do to maybe mitigate against it for us. Yeah, so it's hard to answer that question. It's a good question, but it's hard to answer it. My guess would be no. I think we'll have done sufficient damage that it won't really even be noticeable 10,000, 20,000 years from now.
And I think the other thing we see when we look at, you know, forecasting into the future with free climate, we're going only like 100 years, 150 years. Yeah. We're not going out 100,000 years.
So. That's right.
So what are, you know, what are we predicting, or can we predict anything 100 years out in terms of our climate? What are the models showing?
We try to use a whole slew of different model scenarios is what they're called, and one of them is, let's say we won't do anything to curb our use of fossil fuels. One of them is we do really good job at curbing them, and then one of them is maybe we're halfway in between. So the business as usual, where we don't do anything, I think predicts on the order of 5 to 8 degrees of warming in the next 100 years, right, globally. So how that manifests locally is still a question. We're trying to figure that out using, in some cases, those same models, and in other cases, more sophisticated ones that look at regional weather patterns. But then if we curb our appetite for these fossil fuels and find some substitutes, then we maybe are thinking about a couple of degrees in the next 100 years, and then maybe moving into a regime where we can start to pull back a little bit from that warming. So either way, we have a couple degrees baked into the cake, it looks like, right now. And if we're aggressive in our amelioration, we're better off.
I know there's some discussion about water levels rising and what impact, who owns the property when, if in Florida, for example, you lose a half a mile of shoreline, which would be kind of a problem in a place like Miami.
Yeah. Right.
Yep.
And who's supposed to pay for it?
Yeah, you know, I was just back on the East Coast over the weekend, and in an area that was hit by Superstorm Sandy. And it's really interesting because there are some houses. I mean, there was a lot of flooding that occurred there, and then mold developed and all the kind of really bad problems. So some houses are abandoned, but very few. Most of them are just raising it up.
Is that right?
By 10 feet. I mean, it's just really weird when you walk by it and you see the process of the stoop is like way up, 10 feet above where you are. So, you know, that seems to be one way that people are trying to handle it.
Yeah. Boy.
Well, that doesn't sound like the best way.
It doesn't. That's what I say.
Completely,
I think, you
ad
know,
hoc.
I'm glad I moved off of Long Island.
Right. Man.
It sort of boggles the mind, doesn't it?
It does to me.
And, you know, as John says, who's going to pay for that for the next time you get a flood? Because there will be another flood.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
What are they predicting for, or are there predictions for hurricanes and so forth for the...
Yeah, the coming season, I think I read that the prediction that's generated out of Colorado State University every year, and it's updated, I think, every month or every 2 weeks once the season gets
going.
Now. Named storms, I think I heard. So I could be wrong about that, but I thought I heard 9 named storms, maybe 2 major hurricanes out of that.
So a little below normal.
Yeah, I think a little bit below
normal. Close to normal, actually.
Yeah. I don't... You know, frankly, I don't put much stock into it until we get a little bit later in the season, maybe June 1st or so. Then I think some of the more important signals are a little bit more baked in by then.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to have a positive discussion next time that you guys are here, which is, it's June 25th.
June 25th.
All right, great.
Is the next time we're on. Steve, John, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate
thank you.
It.
Great to be here.
John Martin, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, as is Steve Ackerman. He's also director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. Great to have them both with us, and they will be back on June 25th. Tomorrow at this time, we'll take a look at the safety of our food with the chief scientist in the USAID's Bureau for Food Security. And I hope you'll join us for that. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.